Wynn versus Sunrise Hospital. Parties are ready to proceed. Please do so. Please announce, say for the record who you are, and if you wish, reserve time.
My name is Carrie Early. I'm here for the appellant, Tracy Wynn, who has been substituted in for Robert Wynn, who unfortunately has died during the pendency. On behalf of the minor, Sedona Wynn. Ready to go?
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be in front of you. It's been a long time since I've been up here. I looked at my records. It was Daly versus Sunrise. It's been a long time since I've been here, and it really is a pleasure. As I said, unfortunately, Robert Wynn has died during the pendency, so we did substitute in Tracy Wynn on behalf of Sedona. The framework for the tolling of the statute of limitations under NRS 41A.097, Section 2, for medical malpractice cases is a trier of fact has to consider three factors. Number one, the type of medical treatment that was involved. In this case, we had open heart surgery, which included Sedona being put on what's called a heart-lung bypass machine or a perfusion machine. The second fact that has to be considered by the trier of fact for tolling of the statute of limitations under Section 2 is the type of injury. In this case, we had a complex brain injury. Sedona was injured because of lack of oxygen to her brain that was discovered in post-op day one after her surgery. And the third factors that the trier of fact needs to look at for the tolling of the statute of limitations is the other circumstances that surround the question of new or should have known that there was an injury. The facts of Sedona Wynn are, number one, Sedona was born with a very complex and unfortunately rare congenital birth defect. She had problems with basically the anatomy of her heart. Prior to December 14, 2006, when she was 13 years old, she had gone through various surgeries to actually repair the anatomy of her heart. One of them had been to put in an aortic valve because her heart wasn't working right. On December 14, 2006, she was admitted to Sunrise by Dr. Sekola for a repair of a graft that had been put in so that her aortic valve would work. This is open heart surgery. It required a heart-lung bypass machine. And the records show this was not a minor surgery. Her anesthesia surgery time was 5 hours, as documented by the records. She was on what's called the bypass time, when actually all the blood in her body was taken out. It went through. Her heart was actually stopped. For Dr. Sekola to do the repair on her heart couldn't be beating. Her lungs no longer functioned then. So the perfusion machine actually took out all the blood during that two-hour period.
Counsel, if I can interrupt you to kind of move you along with your argument a little bit. We have the facts that we have this in December. We have the party's father retaining an attorney in January. We have release of records, and you can speak to the sufficiency of these records, in July. And later, we have experts seemingly, and I say seemingly, relying upon the July 7th, 2007 records to opine. So talk about that and concealment.
That's why I wanted to kind of do the background, that this isn't just a minor thing. Number one, it's very easy to be a Monday night quarterback. We finally got all the records, which included, and I will tell you what happened, the time frame on that when the law firm started asking for records. I don't know why they only gave us 182 records initially. I don't know. We never had an answer to that. I certainly don't think Sunrise Hospital gets to decide what records are significant on this type of complex brain injury.
Well, initially, wasn't the only request for the records that would support the Social Security disability claim?
No, there were two.
That was in February of 2007.
There was
correct?
Also letters in February of 2000, and I have the document here, in February of 2007 by the PI, Tracy Rogers. What happens is They need certain records for Social Security. That was being done by Noel. Then the PI case was being handled by Tracy Rogers, who is an RN at the office, who actually gets the records to go for the personal injury claim. Those records were also at, and there were two separates. I understand that. At some point, Noel is trying to get the records that are sufficient to do a Social Security claim, but the records that are sufficient for a personal injury claim, so a medical expert, Tracy was also asking for. And you can see there were records being asked for. The first records that came in February of 07 were 182 pages out of 3,000 pages. They did include the operative report, but they did not include the perfusion records, which is the heart-lung bypass, which is critical, did not include the anesthesia records, did not include any interoperative nursing records, because they're trying to see if something happened in surgery, did not include the MRI CT scan reports, which are critical, because what caused the brain injury? It's one thing to say, hey, you know, we think there may be some error, but to try to find out why the error got to her brain, or whether it was an embolism that was air, whether it was an embolism that was a blood clot, what was the mechanism of how it got there, and if anybody's negligence caused that mechanism is what is required.
Counsel.
That brings me to...
That's okay. Sorry.
If Justice Carragher.
That brings me to the question, the expert's affidavit that supported the complaint. A great deal of that material in the affidavit come from that first production, February of 07.
Except for the MRI and CT scans that did not come until 2008, which was finally, there's even an affidavit by me and Mr. Webster that says, hey, we're still trying to get the MRI and CT scans and reports. Those are critical for causation. As you know, under Massey versus Linton, and especially under the new medical malpractice statute 41A.100, you can't even file a complaint unless you have a medical expert say to a reasonable degree of medical probability not only that there was a breach in the standard of care, but that breach caused the brain damage. For these kind of cases, for an HIE case, that is very complex. Those scans were critical for the expert to say, hey, yes, she got a brain injury, but you know what? On open heart bypass surgery, that is a known complication.
So the crux of your materiality argument as it relates to concealment is just that.
That, as well as it goes to Section 2, because under Massey versus Linton, until we have access to the facts that put the client, the plaintiff, on inquiry notice that there may be, you can't even have inquiry notice until you have the records.
And but you knew when you got the 182 pages that the MRI and CT scans were not among them, correct?
Correct, and we kept asking for them.
Okay, so you knew or should have known at that point that you needed those MRI, and how many times and where in the record does it show that you repeatedly asked for the MRI?
Right here we have a request on February 25th. The last request was July 2nd from Tracy Rogers, who said, we still don't have all the complete records. Could you please supply us with the complete records? Then what happened is when I'm reviewing the case with Tracy, I said, we've got a statute of limitations on if it does go from that date of her surgery, we need these complete records. I actually filed a declaratory relief action because I can't force people to give records. We made request after request. I obviously knew we have a statute of limitations problem. I felt the best way, and if you notice, I filed it November 6, 2007, and what I asked the district court on the deck relief, please order or have a mechanism to get the complete records from Sunrise, because I did it against Sunrise, and could we toll till we get the complete records? Because these aren't cases, and you know, Monday night quarterbacking, well, let's look at the operative report. Let me, you know, they
also, before you go into those reports, okay. Justice Hardesty, did you have a point earlier?
Just my point was, the operative report, my expert went back and said, you know what, there was air in the ventricle. Looking back at the scans and looking at all the material, he must not have gotten all the air out, and that got it to the bloodstream. If that was so obvious as negligence from the operative report, then why didn't Dr. Sekola tell Mr. Nguyen when he asked what happened? If that was such obvious negligence and such an obvious cause that my expert should have been able to look at just the operative report and give an opinion, then why didn't Dr. Sekola tell Mr. Nguyen that, oh, here, you know what? We did find air in the ventricle, and that must have been the reason. If he had even known that, we would have information to go to an expert. He didn't say that. Not one thing. You read Mr. Nguyen's affidavit. And he asked. He was told, we don't know. We're trying to figure it out. You know, unfortunately, on these type of open heart surgeries, it can happen. But they never told him. The first time he found out is when we got the records. And the other thing on these kind of cases, it's very difficult to get experts to review all this and give these opinion on these cases. It's not like a case where we're working, like on the Banks case. We're working on a torn rotator cuff, okay? You're not supposed to get a brain injury because you're doing a mechanical. We're taking all her blood out. A machine is actually oxygenating it, putting it back in the bloodstream. It's known that an embolism can lodge anywhere in the body. Unfortunately, the worst place it can lodge is the brain, and that's what happened with Sedona. And they expected, at the time, the records show they thought it was an embolism, not sure if it was an air, not sure if it was a blood clot, but they surely didn't know the mechanism of how it got there, and they certainly didn't know, which they need under Massey, that legal injury, which is two-part, just not the physical injury, but Massey's very plain, plus facts accessible that it was medical negligence by an expert that caused the brain injury. Our argument is until we have the records, I agree that once we get all the records, at least I'm not an expert. I'm not an HIE expert. I've done this long enough to know I think I know a lot, and I don't presume to tell you of all the cases I had that I felt like I had enough records that a doctor should do this. I do know that every time I send piecemeal records, the experts will go, hey, we need CT scans. In fact, the biggest thing that held us up were the MRI CT films. But until an expert gets that and tells you that, this is not a small process. It's not one like a res ipsa, say, oh, okay, we have a bovipad burn. You're not supposed to have a bovipad burn. I had a case when you have a tonsillectomy. And Massey is right on point when it says facts accessible. The plaintiff or the patient is not put on inquiry notice of a legal injury until the facts are accessible. On a complex case like this, the medical records is all we have. And as you notice, we can't take depositions. We can't, prior to filing a complaint, we don't get to take depositions or find out more facts. It's limited anyway on just the facts, which makes it even harder. And you just can't throw a complaint up. You know, like under Massey versus Linton, you could file a complaint. Under the new statute, as you know, you have to have an affidavit. And if you don't have an affidavit by an expert, it shall be dismissed. So which, you're kind of between a rock
counsel,
and a hard place.
Which
yes.
Leads to the question I wanted to ask.
Okay, I apologize.
That's okay. The affidavit, you filed your complaint in February of 2007.
Excuse me,
2009.
No, correct.
Yes. And the affidavits that were attached were from Dr. Russo and Mr. Farrell?
Correct. Our experts who were in November. End of October, early November of 2008 is when I got the affidavits back.
Okay. Could you tell me what the affidavits say about the MRI and the CT scan?
What the affidavits say is that...
Do you have them there? Do you have them there? Could you quote from them what they say about the MRI and the CT scan?
They don't specifically necessarily note to them.
Well, I mean, they either... use the words MRI or they don't, or they use the word CT scan or they don't. What do they say about the CT scan and the MRI?
I don't know if they know if they specifically say, I reviewed the MRI, I reviewed the CT scan, but I know, based on doing these cases, that you can't connect a brain injury without those.
Well, I'm just asking you, they were your experts.
I don't have them directly in front of me, but I do know what they do say is, that I was able to review all the records. After looking at all the records, which includes the MRI and CT scans, I then, because you have to go backwards, you have to go from the injury to try to figure out how it happened.
Then let me approach my question this way. I understood your argument to be that the MRI and the CT scan were critical components of the expert's opinions in this case. Either in the district court or in your briefs here, did you indicate how the record shows that those two reports were critical to the expert's opinions?
Did I do an affidavit to that effect? As you know, this
or even argue in pleadings to the district court or in your brief that
I know I have argued that they needed the complete records, which included the MRI and CT scans.
No,
I know
I'm asking you specifically, did you argue to the district court or in your briefs here that at least these two reports, which were provided late in discovery, were critical components to the opinion of the experts?
Yes, Your Honor, I do know I have argued that because I know they can't give the brain injury. I know that. Yes, I have, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that's a critical factor when you back up from causation. You have to go backwards to forwards. And the one thing to be able to say, oh, well, now it's the air ventricle. It was just sitting there in the report. That doesn't answer the causation. And Massey versus Linton says you have to have access to the facts that not only the breach of the standard of care, but that it proximately caused. And that's what was difficult in this case, because no one knew why, especially on the overlay of this is a known complication because of the perfusion machine. It's rare, but it is a known complication. So that even makes it harder, because then you have to say with a known complication, we have to take it out of that genre and make it somebody's medical negligence. These are some of the toughest cases to get experts to actually give an affidavit that a healthcare provider was negligent for this type of complication.
Counsel, we've used all your time.
I'm
however,
sorry.
We'll give you 3 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Douglas, members of the court. My name is Ken Webster. I represent Sunrise Hospital. May it please the court, I'd like to start. I had the luxury of time sitting over there while Justice Hardesty asked his question of Ms. Early. And I'd like to start by answering Justice Hardesty's question about whether or not the affidavit of Dr. Russo and Mr. Farrow that were attached to the complaint addressed the issue of the MRI and the CT. In an appellant's appendix, page 19, Dr. Russo states that the EEG, or electroencephalogram, that was done December 16th, which is the second day after surgery, showed a severely abnormal brain study. Now, it's undisputed that they had the electroencephalogram when Sunrise first produced the medical records among that 182 pages. So based on the EEG, they had information that indicated that there was a severe brain injury that included cortical involvement. With respect to the MRI question that Justice Hardesty asked, it says, furthermore, the MRI of the brain performed on December 26 revealed an acute infarct within the right external capsule with suspected extension into the right cerebral pendulum midbrain. It was noted that the enhancement most likely represented diffuse subacute infarcts that might be due to an emboli. So,
but counsel, I don't think there's much dispute about that there was findings of an injury. The question that at least I'm hearing the appellant argue is, we know there was an injury, we know where it lodged. Now we have to go through the two-prong step to determine, or have our experts determine, what caused it. Was it in fact someone's negligence?
Well, and I think that Ms. Early maybe overstates the requirements of NRS 41A071, the affidavit requirement, Your Honor, Justice, because what it talks about is that you have to have an expert affidavit that establishes the credibility or the meritoriousness of the lawsuit. And the way that that's being applied in the district courts, there's no specific case in the state of Nevada that addresses this particular issue. But the way that's been addressed and dealt with by the trial courts is that as long as that affidavit establishes a violation of the standard of care by a competent expert, that's sufficient to meet the requirements of 41A071 for filing of the complaint. Now, once they get through that process, I mean, clearly that is a threshold, predicate fact that they must address. And then once we go through the discovery process, and then at the time of trial, in order to survive a motion for summary judgment or motion for directed verdict, then they've got to establish the requirements of 41A100, which says that they've got to then prove causation. But the causation aspect of it isn't something that's necessarily required in that initial affidavit. But I would submit that even when Sunrise Hospital first produced that 182 pages of medical records, it specifically talked about the EEG. There's no dispute that that EEG performed on December 16th was in that production of documents, which showed that there was a severely abnormal study showing involvement of cortical brainstem. And there's nothing in Sedona Wynn's history prior to that event that would indicate that she had any brain impairment. And that's why the trial court looked at this case and said, when you've got a child like Sedona Wynn who goes in for what is considered a minor heart repair, even though it sounds horrifying, medicine, that's considered minor, and she comes out with seizures, she's in a comatose state, she's in a persistent vegetative state, and you have an EEG that establishes the existence of an injury, that is sufficient to put him, Mr. Wynn, on inquiry notice of his possible cause of action. And if you look at the affidavits that were submitted by plaintiff's counsel, they look specifically to the operative note that was written by Dr. Socolo when the procedure occurred. And specifically, Dr. Russo, in his affidavit, points out that Dr. Socolo stated in his operative report dated December 14th, so the day of the procedure, signed by him, that air was found in the left ventricle during the procedure. It is well known in the medical and cardiac surgical communities that more likely than not, air found in the left ventricle during this phase of the procedure performed by Dr. Socolo on beating heart and without occlusion of the aorta causes cerebral embolism, which occurred in this case. So based on that fact alone, the mere fact that they had that op note written by Dr. Socolo on the day of the event, and they had the EEG as early as February of 2007, there's no dispute that that has to be the time, at the very latest, when the statute of limitations began to run.
What about the tolling argument and the concealment issue? Why is that not a question of fact that perhaps wasn't appropriate for summary judgment?
Respectfully, Justice, I think that when you look at what the tolling argument suggests, it suggests that there was some concealment of evidence. And what you have here is kind of a tortured history with respect to the request by the Richard Harris Law Firm for Sunrise Hospital to produce these records. 3 weeks after the surgery, while Sedona was still a patient at Sunrise Hospital, the Harris Law Firm sent a letter saying, we are requesting records for a personal injury action that we're looking for. And then they go on to state, now we're going to look for records because we're pursuing a Social Security claim as well. And under the law, you're required to produce us medical records for free to address the Social Security issue. We gathered those records, and then we got a letter saying, disregard, cancel all other prior orders from the Richard Harris Law Firm for medical records and don't send us an invoice.
When was that?
That first letter was sent on 2-8-07, when Ms. Ungren called and canceled the request for records in the personal injury action. On 2-14, which was 6 days later, Sunrise sent the 182 pages for the Social Security claim. Then on 2-25, plaintiff sent another letter asking for records for the personal injury claim again. On 5-1,
there's only a two-week hiatus where they asked you to stand down from the two- or three-week hiatus in not producing the personal injury records, correct?
Correct. And in addition to that, I neglected to mention a point there, Justice Pickering, was that when they sent their initial request in January, they said, we want all records from the date of her surgery through today. And that was January 8th. That's what the consent form said. And under HIPAA, we have to have dates of service that they specifically want in the release before we can turn over those records. So when we said, Sedona is still an inpatient in the hospital, if you want those records, with no problem, but you've got to get us a new release because otherwise you're only going to get records up to January 8th. We never got another release. And so that's a problem. But then again, on May 1st, I believe it was, we got another letter saying, cancel all prior requests, don't send us any bills. And then from July until December, July until November, when Ms. Early filed the declaratory relief action, there was no activity at all trying to gather these medical records.
What does the record show with respect to requests for the MRI and CT scans? MRI films and CT scans.
When the declaratory relief action was filed, Ms. Early and I communicated with each other, and I said, we'll gather the records for you. We'll even cut you a deal on the cost. I think she paid $1,500, and it was a $3,000 bill. Once the records were sent to her office, her assistant sent me an email saying, we're missing CT reports, MRIs, and something else. I looked at the records, the copy of the records I kept that were turned over to Ms. Early, and I said, you know what, you're right, we're missing them too. I'll gather them, and I'll send them over to you. And that happened sometime in February 2008. So there's absolutely no dispute that that occurred, but I think it's immaterial to the issue of whether or not they had facts sufficient to put them on notice of the claim. And I think the affidavits attached to the complaint spell that out in great detail, when the only mention of the MRI, as Justice Hardesty questioned, was that it might be indicative of an air emboli, but that the mere fact that there was air in the line itself, in the ventricle, indicates a standard of care violation. I don't know how to read this clock. It says I have 6 minutes, but we're splitting the time. Am I done?
6 minutes
of my seven?
No.
Total. All right. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. My name is Shirley Blazich, and I represent the respondents, clinical technician associates, Robert Twells and Mr. Steffen. Because the court has focused on the concealment issue, I will jump right to that and simply address the fact that my clients had no involvement in any of the aspects that have been argued by counsel for Sunrise and by counsel for the appellants. Basically, by the time that CTA, Mr. Steffen, and Mr. Twelves were added to the lawsuit, the DEC relief action had already been filed and had already been dismissed, and we were all sort of grouped together along with respondent Dr. Sokolo into whatever had already been established in terms of the sort of tortured procedural history of obtaining the medical records. So the statute, NRS 41A.097, basically states that when a provider of health care conceals an act, the statute may be told as to that provider of health care. My clients, it is never alleged that they concealed any acts, and even the complaint basically makes no statements that anybody acting on behalf of CTA, Mr. Twells, or Mr. Steffen ever did anything to conceal any of the acts. Therefore, the tolling statute should not be applied as to my clients. The other aspect that is addressed by NRS 41A is that when the provider of health care conceals an act upon which the action is based, the statute can be told. In this case, the action is based upon the operative report that was produced in the 182 pages produced by Sunrise Hospital in February of 2007. The experts had those reports and relied extensively upon those reports when issuing their expert affidavits. That was done not only by Dr. Russo, but also by Mr. Farrow, the perfusionist expert. The experts went into that operative report to say that the air in the ventricle was the likely cause of the brain damage. So the action is based on that operative report. That was not an item that was concealed by anybody in this case. And arguably, the appellants have never even stated that the operative report was concealed. Therefore, the tolling shouldn't apply as to any of the respondents in this case. Lastly, I will just put out that the...
Well, what did the experts say about your client's liability in their affidavits?
They relied upon the operative report.
And what did they say was the failure to satisfy the standard of care?
That there was likely air found in the heart ventricles and that it was the responsibility of the perfusion team and the machinery to prevent that from
happening. That's who your clients are, the perfusion team?
That's right, who operate the heart-lung machine that pumps the blood and oxygenates the blood while the heart is being stopped from beating. So plaintiffs also never requested any medical records from CTA, from Mr. Twells or Mr. Stephan. Therefore, there has never been any allegation that these particular individuals failed to respond to any kind of records request.
Furthermore, we haven't reached the legal question about whether concealment by one provider could affect tolling as to another provider. Can you see a circumstance where concealment by one provider might properly invoke the tolling statute where an expert's determination of malpractice as to the other provider might depend on those unproduced records?
I can't see a situation where tolling should be applied to another party not responsible for the act of concealment. If there is a legitimate allegation of concealment, then I would believe that there would be some type of remedy available against the concealed
party. Counsel here argues that it was essential to have the MRI and the CT scan in order to demonstrate causation. Sounds like records that would be necessary in order for, if you accept her argument, would be necessary in order to make a determination about causation as to your clients.
Well, I think the matter was argued very well by counsel for Sunrise in that an expert affidavit need only make a causal connection. So they only really need to say there was a breach of the standard of care and it caused the injury. The specific details of how the injury was caused isn't something that needs to be spelled out clearly in the initial expert affidavit. It is something that would be testified to by the expert at trial or produced later on in the case when additional expert reports are furnished. So knowing every particular instance of whether it was a brain embolism or whether or not it was something else that caused the actual injury, the experts don't need to have all of that knowledge. So they wouldn't need to have the MRI or the CT scan necessarily to be able to state generally that there was causation or proximate cause between the breach of the standard of care and the actual injury suffered.
But at some point, concealment by another party, Sunrise in this instance, they may have the only records that are relevant to the care that was provided by your client. And in that instance, it would, even if the concealment didn't toll it, wouldn't it be a knew or had reason to know kind of situation vis-a-vis your client? I hear you saying that you don't see any room for concealment to ever apply to another co-party. But it seems to me if Sunrise had produced nothing and had destroyed the records, let's hypothesize that, the plaintiff would not have access to the records needed to investigate and state the claim. Therefore, under Massey, the statute wouldn't start to run against anybody, correct?
Well, in this particular case, though,
I understand that, but you overstated your argument then if you're saying that concealment or record suppression would never affect a claim against a co-party.
Well, in this case, Your Honor, that it wouldn't because there was never any records request made to CTA.
Right.
So the appellants never even took that stuff. Yes, they requested records from Sunrise, but even if the records were never available, they had other avenues.
Does the record show whether or not your client even had any records or whether they were all with Sunrise?
They were all with Sunrise.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very briefly, may it please the court. I have just a moment. I know my time's up.
Counsel, actually, there's no more time, but I'll give you 2 minutes. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. May it please the court. I'm Dave Mortensen. I represent Dr. Sokolo. Very briefly, in terms of the concealment for acts of another, I believe you raised that question, Justice Hardesty. We've cited cases in our brief that indicate that concealment by one party cannot be imputed to one party. So we think that's a pretty settled law. Just in summary,
not in this state.
Not in this state. You are correct. You are correct.
That's why I posed the hypothetical to your co-counsel, and I'll raise it with you. it seems a bit unfair to have a circumstance like the hypothetical posited by Justice Pickering, and yet the provider statute runs and no records were ever produced.
Well, I will note for the record in this case, there weren't any requests for records to my client either. But in answer to your question, I can see a scenario, I presume, where there would be a concealment that could be acquiesced to by another party that had knowledge of a hospital. For example, in our situation, if Dr. Sokolo, if there was evidence in the record that he knew Sunrise Hospital was or was not giving partial records, maybe I can see that. But it would be inherently unfair to extend effectively the statute of limitations against Dr. Sokolo because of the acts of that he did not know about.
And was a record request made of him?
No request was made of Dr. Sokolo.
And I was a little bit unclear as to his relationship to the hospital. Is he an employee?
Independent contractor. I strike that. He's not an independent contractor. He's on staff there.
That's right.
This isn't in the record, of course. It wasn't an issue that was.
So if I may alter Justice Pickering's hypothetical slightly, if a record request has been made to the hospital and to the physician, and the physician says, because I'm on staff, I'm going to hand over this record request to the hospital, and the hospital doesn't produce the records, do you think in that circumstance we should adopt a rigid rule that prevents the tolling from applying to him as a provider?
If Dr. Sokolo or a physician in that circumstance made the affirmative representation that all of my, first of all, they're asked for records.
Doesn't represent anything, just refers the request to the hospital.
If he refers the request to the hospital but is not aware of the alleged concealment, I don't see that how he or she could be held responsible for that. And I see that my time is up. I appreciate the court giving me a few extra minutes. Thank you.
Ms. Early, can I ask you this? I know you have limited time, but could you tell me, this is in response to the argument from Sunrise, from the early summer of 2007 until you filed the declaratory relief action, I believe you said it was November of 2007, what did you do to try and gather these additional records?
What I had was I had the Tracy Rogers RRN write another letter, like the third request in July. I said, because, you know, we've done all these requests, but we need the complete records. She did it in July, waiting to get the records. When we started reviewing it, I had her go through, and she put in her affidavit, see if you think there's enough that we can get an expert. She says to me, and I rely on, we don't have the CT scans. We don't have the MRI. So we need the complete records. That's when I reviewed it in November, and I go, oh, my goodness, we have a problem here. I don't have a mechanism. That's why I thought the declaratory relief would take care of all these issues of requesting and getting that. And when I worked with Mr. Webster, we did accomplish getting that, and I appreciate him clarifying it was in February of 2008 we got the MRI report. So we did another request in July. I mean, I agree it was torturous, and I don't know why. I don't know why they piecemealed it. I know it can be confusing when the Social Security Department is asking for their reasons, but we did separate requests. If we had not tried to get the records and were trying to rely on Social Security, that would be pretty silly when we did our own separate requests. We're not very good at trying to not pay, are we? I mean, that's just a silly argument to me, Your Honor. But one thing I really want to address, it's easy to say, oh, well, look at the op report. Look at the expert. They look at that there was air in the ventricle. But I can't get an expert to say that was below the standard of care until they understand what the causation is.
So what does your record show on that? Do your motion papers have an affidavit that say, this expert says I cannot opine as to causation without access to the MRI and CT scan records?
There is an affidavit by me that says that the experts would not review this type of case without the complete records. You can't even get them to do it because although that you can put in it, and they've done it before, well, I'll reserve my right to change my opinion, they can get crucified and cross-examined when, oh, you said this in your affidavit. Oh, now, doctor, you're now giving a deposition.
So you offered your own?
I offered my own and my experience, and trying to get the experts on this case to get to review it.
What does the record show was the date the experts you tendered first reviewed records?
You know what? I don't think we put it in when I actually got, and I did send it. I know, obviously, I did it after we had all the records, February 12, 2008, because then I know I'm not piecemealing. And what happens is if you do send, first of all, they won't review it. I will be honest. They're very expensive, as I'm sure you could understand. And if you try to piecemeal it, they want all the records at one time. But once I did, it was sent, I will tell you, it was sent immediately because I know these experts can take 6 to 9 months, which is really a very difficult situation under this 1 year statute of limitations to even get someone of this caliber to look at these kind of cases and give opinions within a short time frame. It's very difficult. And one other issue, there's no other records other than the hospital records. I didn't make a request to Chicholo or to the perfusionist because this is all based on the hospital records. They only met Sedona in the OR for that record. Dr. Chicholo would, as far as what happened in surgery, that's all the hospital records. There was nothing separate to get from them. If I had another place to get it, I would have gotten it. Thank you very much.
Court thanks counsel for both sides for the arguments this morning that enlightened us as to the issues before us. This matter will stand.